From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tomorrow is the 30th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, the day British troops opened fire on Catholic demonstrators in Northern Ireland. 27 people were shot, 13 of them were killed. It was a turning point in the escalation of the conflict. On today's Fresh Air, we remember that day with journalists Peter Pringle and Philip Jacobson. The day after Bloody Sunday, they were part of a team of journalists sent by the Sunday Times of London to investigate what happened. They also collaborated on the recent book, Those Are Real Bullets. Their notes are being used as part of the British government's current investigation into Bloody Sunday. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Gone, the debut novel by Martin Roper. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush is preparing to deliver his State of the Union address tonight, laying out his agenda for action in the war on terrorism, homeland defense, and the economy. The president will also renew a call to reform the Medicare health program. But on Capitol Hill, Democrats are already calling his proposals inadequate. NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
Mr. Bush will ask Congress to spend $190 billion over the next 10 years to modernize the way Medicare works, including adding outpatient prescription drug coverage. Included in that amount will be $77 billion for states to use the Medicaid program to help pay for medicines for seniors with incomes between 100 and 150% of the federal poverty level. But Democrats and even some Republicans say what the president is seeking is not nearly enough. They say a meaningful Medicare drug benefit is likely to cost at least $300 billion. And while they prefer the Medicaid approach to a block grant proposal the president offered last year, they still want to devote their energies to trying to craft a drug benefit for all Medicare recipients. Julie Rovner, NPR News, The Capitol.
An energy consultant told a Senate hearing today that Enron Corporation may have been manipulating long-term electricity prices on the West Coast. Robert McCullough, who works for several Western utilities, pointed to a sharp drop in long-term electricity prices in the week after Enron announced its bankruptcy. Pat Wood, the chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, said he'd look into the price drop, but he noted that his agency doesn't regulate many long-term electricity transactions. The bankrupt Enron Corporation has a new CEO, NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Enron's board of directors tapped Stephen Cooper to head the struggling energy company. Cooper is a corporate turnaround specialist whose firm has helped to reorganize many bankrupt companies, including Sunbeam and Federated Department Stores. Cooper told employees he's confident that Enron will emerge from bankruptcy. David Skeel, who teaches bankruptcy law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, says if so, the once giant trading company will be much different and smaller.
It's likely to be focused more on old economy kinds of assets. What they're going to have left are things like some of the pipelines and things of that sort.
Enron has already sold off its flagship energy trading operation to a Swiss bank, but the company still employs some 19,000 people worldwide. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 247 points, or 2.5%, to close at 9,618 in very heavy trading of more than 1.7 billion shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 51 points, or 2.6%. It closed at 1,895. The S&P 500 lost 32 points to close at 1,100. This is NPR News. A woman who was rescued from the 88th floor of the World Trade Center on September the 11th has been released from a New York hospital. Elaine Dutch inhaled jet fuel and was burned over 77% of her body when the jetliner struck the building. Today, her head still bandaged, and the 49-year-old woman was wheeled from the hospital burn center. She was wearing a New York Fire Department cap. In New York City, 12 employees of the Port Authority have been charged with stealing money from two charities that were helping victims of the World Trade Center attacks. NPR's Melissa Block reports.
11 of the Port Authority workers escaped safely from the Trade Center. Another was not at work that day. The employees filed claims with the American Red Cross and with Safe Horizon, allegedly claiming they had lost their jobs because of the terrorist attacks and needed emergency assistance. The charities gave the workers a total of more than $19,000 to pay for rent, groceries, and transportation. But according to the Manhattan District Attorney, the workers were still employed and were paid their full salaries for their days of missed work. They've been charged with larceny. In a separate case, four people are charged with stealing $20,000 from the Federal Emergency Management Agency for claiming their apartments were damaged during the Trade Center collapse. According to the district attorney, the apartments sustained no damage. Melissa Block, NPR News, New York.
Rescue teams have reached the wreckage of an Ecuadorian jetliner that crashed yesterday in Colombia. They say there's no sign of survivors. 92 people were aboard the plane when it crashed into the side of a volcano yesterday. The cause of the crash is not known, but officials say visibility in the area is often obscured by fog. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, helping feed the more than 31 million Americans at risk of hunger through initiatives such as Campus Kitchen Project, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tomorrow marks the 30th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, the day in which British paratroopers opened fire on a Catholic civil rights march in Derry, Northern Ireland, killing 13 unarmed people and wounding 14 others. It marked a turning point in the escalation of the conflict, inspiring many outraged Catholics to join the IRA. The day after Bloody Sunday, my guests, British journalists Peter Pringle and Philip Jacobson, were sent to Derry as part of a team of reporters investigating what happened for the Sunday Times of London. In April 1972, the official British government's report was released, saying that the military fired in self-defense or in the defense of others. Shortly after, the Sunday Times published its investigation, finding that the military's use of violence was out of all proportion to what it faced and reckless in the extreme. Reporters Pringle and Jacobson have returned to Derry over the years, continuing to report on the conflict. Their book, Those Are Real Bullets, will be published in paperback in March. Meanwhile, they've become part of the story. A new inquiry into Bloody Sunday was opened by the Tony Blair government. The Sunday Times complied with a request to turn over their reporters' notes without first asking for the reporters' permission, as we'll discuss later. But let's start with the story of Bloody Sunday. Let's go back 30 years. What was the state of the Troubles just before Bloody Sunday?
Well, basically what you had was the end of the peaceful civil rights movement, the marches, which had started in 1968. They were basically about housing discrimination, job discrimination, school discrimination.
Against Catholics?
Against Catholics, yes. Those marches drew on the civil rights movement to a large extent in the United States. And it led on to some violent demonstrations with the rearming of the IRA. And when you reached... let's see, about 6 months before Bloody Sunday, was another turning point, which was the beginning of so-called internment. And this was the point at which the British Army rounded up all the 300 or so believed suspects of the IRA. Most of them were older members, and put them in jail and held them there without due process.
And at this point, the British Army was becoming, well, like the police force in Northern Ireland.
Well, it had effectively replaced the police force. The RUC, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, was not able to venture into any of the no-go zones. Those were in the Catholic heartlands, in the ghettos of Belfast and Derry. If they did, they required a huge army escort. The Catholics had essentially refused to recognise the authority of the police. The army were then dragged slowly, and as it now is very clear from memorandums, very unwillingly into the role of policing a civilian society for which the army was completely untrained, and a society which increasingly resented its presence, having once welcomed it with cups of tea as liberators of the Catholic community.
Now, you point out that the army that was policing Northern Ireland had actually cut its teeth on counterinsurgency campaigns in the jungles of Borneo and Malaya, in the deserts of Oman, when England was at the end of its period as a colonial power, and now they were enforcing the law on fellow Britons. What impact do you think they had on their approach to enforcing the law?
Well, it was completely unknown territory as far as British Army was concerned. First of all, one has to remember they were doing it not live on television, but in front of a British audience, that every evening British television viewers on the mainland saw what was happening in the streets of Belfast and Londonderry. They heard interviews with generals trying to explain why British troops could be seen battening and tear-gassing British citizens. And the army was completely unequipped for this. You've got to remember that it was an army that was largely, apart from counterinsurgency and distant colonies where nobody took a great deal of interest, it was an army trained to fight the Russians in Europe as part of NATO. So you were putting in soldiers trained for the battlefield, armed with battlefield weapons, into a situation that they had no experience of, no training for, and the inevitable happened, that frictions between army and civilians very quickly developed, and then they were caught up in an increasing spiral of violence on both sides.
What was the initial march about on January 30th, 1972?
It was about an anti-internment march. It was against the picking up, mostly in the middle of the night, of suspected IRA members and interning them without trial. And during that 6 months, from the middle of 1971 until January 72, was a time when those interned, as we discovered on the Sunday Times Insight team, were being very roughly treated indeed inside the jails of Northern Ireland. And indeed, they were undergoing torture to the extent of what Amnesty International would call torture. And we discovered that. We uncovered it. We wrote about it. And it was an increasingly unpopular move by the army. And increasingly, they had marches against it, to the extent that all marches at the time, by the time Bloody Sunday came along, were banned. And this was an illegal march, which had been planned by the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Movement. And the army knew about it. The army had forewarning of it. Everybody knew about it. And they decided that they would stop this march, stop the marches going to the centre of Derry, to the Guildhall, to make their speeches. And the rest, of course, is history.
So the British Army knew that this march was going to happen. The army was worried about it. What were some of the controversies and disagreements within the army about how to proceed, what the army should do for its strategy during the march?
The local commander in Derry, a brigadier, who had two regiments under his command, who were very experienced in Derry. They knew the highways and byways of the Catholic areas, in particular the Bogside. The commander, it becomes clear as you read material, particularly recently developed by Saville, had great misgivings about attempting to stop the marches by force if necessary, but he was under orders from his superior officer, who was the general in charge of Northern Ireland. And gradually one sees a plan emerging by which the march will be stopped and the maximum number of rioters, who were described as young Derry hooligans, these were seasoned teenage rioters who turned out most afternoons to pelt the army with bricks and stones. There would be what so-called scoop-up operation would be conducted to net as many of these people as possible and get them off the street. The army was talking about 300, perhaps a maximum of 300, who would be arrested and charged and hopefully imprisoned.
The teenage stone throwers who you mentioned, they were considered troublemakers and they were dangerous. They were a threat to the army, but they weren't members of the IRA. So why were the stone throwers considered that important by the military?
The problem for the army was that every single afternoon, as Phil said, around about 3 or 4 o'clock or when school came out, they would gather at a place called Agro Corner. And Agro Corner was kind of the entrance to the Bogside and the entrance to the no-go area, the free area, that had been declared free Derry by the people of Derry. And inside that area, it was almost impossible for the troops to go on patrol without being sniped at, fired at, by the IRA. And what happened was that free Derry area became a sort of haven for these young Derry hooligans who every now and again strayed into the centre of town. The IRA strayed into the centre of town. And this was a great embarrassment for the British government. And Whitehall and then Prime Minister Ted Heath decided that this embarrassment was enough, and they had to do something about it. And as Phil said, it was tricky to know what to do. You know, the young stone throwers were only throwing stones and perhaps nail bombs and petrol bombs every now and again, but it wasn't a concentrated lethal force. But they were providing cover for IRA snipers. So the army felt that it had to do something about these stone throwers.
Now, you described how the march on Bloody Sunday started off as a civil rights march to specifically protest the internment of IRA leaders who were apparently being tortured during their internment. How did the civil rights march end up turning into a riot?
The march began, as it were, at the top of the hill in the Craigan estate and came down into the Bogside. And the army's idea was that it should be contained within the Bogside area. And so they had barriers at various points of entry into the Bogside. And the one barrier which was important was the one which stopped the marchers going towards the Guildhall, which was in the centre of the city, where they were going to have their speeches and their rally. And when the marchers got down to this particular barrier, which was at the bottom of a street called William Street, they found this barricade of barbed wire and armoured cars and troops in riot gear, all ready to fire CS gas and rubber bullets.
CS gas is tear gas.
Yes. And this was nothing unusual in itself. I mean, it had been, they had experienced this kind of rioting before. The troops had experienced it. The rioters had been in situations where CS gas had been hurled at them. But what they tried to do, what the marchers tried to do, and the organizers of the march, the civil rights organizers of the march, tried to turn them, when they saw these barriers, they tried to turn the marchers back into the Bogside, stop them going down William Street, but they failed. And in the lead were many of the so-called Derry Young Hooligans, who every day had been pelting the army with stones at Agra Corner. And they got to the barrier first, and very quickly it became clear that this was going to turn nasty. And they started picking up stones, and then they picked up larger chunks of concrete and iron bars, etc., and started hurling them at the troops. And the troops, who were not paratroopers at the barrier, manning the barrier, decided that they had to retaliate, so they started firing rubber bullets and tear gas, and eventually it turned into a full-scale riot.
And how did the paratroopers with the actual rifles move in?
Well, the paratroopers had been designated to be the force, the scoop-up force. They were the toughest of the troops around. They regarded themselves as elite troops. In Belfast, they had a fearsome reputation for busting up riots with maximum violence, though not firearms. And they had been distributed at two or three points on the basis of a plan, which soon started to come apart, that they would be able to surround the rioters and drive them towards a holding area where they could all be picked up and arrested. However, the plan, which was thrown together at very short notice, proved to be pretty well ineffectual in the circumstances. So what we had was the paratroop commander, Colonel Wilford, making up his tactics pretty much on the hop as the situation developed, and it developed very quickly. The paratroopers were themselves very hyped up. It's clear from some of the contemporary testimony from members of the parachute regiment that they believed that they had been sent down to do a job that the other army regiments couldn't do, and that they were going to do it and demonstrate how tough they were, and at one bound, so to speak, clean up the Derry problem.
Peter Pringle and Philip Jacobson are the authors of a book about Bloody Sunday called Those Are Real Bullets. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Tomorrow is the 30th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. My guests, British journalists Peter Pringle and Philip Jacobson, are the authors of a book about it called Those Are Real Bullets. Have you been able to find out if there was an order given at any one point to go ahead and open fire?
Well, who fired the first shot, of course, is one of the great mysteries that we hope that Lord Savile will be able to unravel.
Do you mean which side or?
Yeah. Because shots were fired from both sides. The total, if one was to look at it like that, is something like 108 shots from the paratroopers to a dozen plus, maybe up to 30, 40 from the IRA. But what is quite clear is that all the shots, most of the shots fired by the paratroopers were fired before most of the shots fired by the IRA. Then the question is who fired the first shot. The mystery is that as they came down William Street, and before they got to this barrier, and before the rioting really started, there were three shots from the army and one shot from the IRA. The three shots from the army were said to be, by the soldiers in testimony at the original inquiry, were aimed at two of the marchers who were said to have been throwing nail bombs or some kind of explosive bomb, homemade bomb, at the paratroopers who were simply sitting and waiting for the order to go in and arrest them. The two who were hit by these three shots were a 15-year-old boy and a 59-year-old man. Neither, according to the eyewitness accounts, not only of those who were on the march, but as independent observers in the sense of media, and there were a lot of media there, saw any nail bombs, heard any nail bombs. And so it is assumed that those from the testimony, one can infer that they were mistaken. The paratroopers who fired at them were mistaken. They were both wounded in the leg.
You tell the story in your book about Bloody Sunday of several of the people who were killed by British paratroopers. Tell us the story of Barney McGuigan.
Well, this comes almost at the end of the shooting. Just to put you in the picture here, the actual shooting itself took place in an area about the size of a football field. Basically what happened is that the paratroopers rushed in, the marchers fled, as did the young hooligans, and some of them got behind barricades, they got behind low walls, they got behind little side streets, and the paratroopers chased them into this area the size of the football pitch. And by the time they'd got almost to the other end of the pitch, as it were, if you can imagine that, few of the marchers were still there, and that's when the last of the killings happened. And in the particular case of Barney McGuigan, he was a 41-year-old father of six, unemployed painter. He saw one of the wounded, or one of those who was trying to crawl away, or run away, crawl away from the oncoming paratroopers. And this particular person, the other person, was named Paddy Doherty. He was actually crawling at the time that he was shot from behind. The bullet entered his buttock, came up into his chest, and killed him. But before he died, he was crying out for help. And Barney McGuigan was taking cover behind a telephone box, one of those red telephone boxes that you remember from Britain. And he was saying to the others, "I can't stand this, I can't stand this, I have to go to the aid of Paddy Doherty, I have to go and help him, I have to bring him in out of the open and into some cover." And they all said, "No, no, no, you mustn't go out, you mustn't go out, they'll shoot you." And he said, "They won't shoot me if I wave a white handkerchief." So he took out his hanky, he put it above his head, he started to wave it, and he went out, took from the cover of the telephone box towards the dying Paddy Doherty. And as he came out from cover, he was shot in the back of the head, and he died instantly.
One woman was shot on Bloody Sunday. What was her story?
Well, this was Peggy Deary, who was, I think, a mother of 16.
14, I think.
14, yes. Who was caught in the main area to which marchers were retreating when the paratroopers first came into the enclave. She was quite unmistakably a woman. She was dressed in skirt, and I think she had boots with high heels on. She was shot in the leg, a wound that almost took her leg off. And this was at quite close range. And while she was on the ground, her testimony records, she begged the paratrooper not to kill her, because he'd taken aim at her again, because she was the mother of 14. He didn't shoot. She was subsequently carried away to some houses nearby, where medics from the Knights of Malta organization, which is an organization that used to go out on riot days to treat what were usually small-scale injuries, cuts, bruises and bumps, desperately tried to staunch the bleeding. They were able just about to do that, although her leg was in a terrible mess, and she was subsequently evacuated to hospital.
So are these two people whose stories you just told us fairly typical of the people who were shot on Bloody Sunday?
You have a cross-section here. You have some of the stone-throwing youths, some who had been involved in stone-throwing, were killed. Say half a dozen of those, maybe. And then you have others who were literally running away from the advancing paratroopers. One was a worker at the local newspaper. He was a compositor, and he was taking pictures with his cine camera. He was killed. Another one was a businessman who happened to be coming out from an alleyway at the opposite end to where a paratrooper was advancing, and the paratrooper simply shot him. There's absolutely no doubt that he had never had anything to do with the IRA and had not been involved in the rioting. So it wasn't only those who were in the forefront, as it were, only those who were the object of the paratrooper's task, which was to go and arrest the young hooligans, but it was others as well.
Peter Pringle and Philip Jacobson are the authors of a book about Bloody Sunday called Those Are Real Bullets. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Matter of Dignity, Changing the Lives of the Disabled, a work of nonfiction by Andrew Potok. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on Bloody Sunday. We continue our conversation with journalists Peter Pringle and Philip Jacobson, and Maureen Corrigan reviews Gone, the debut novel by Martin Roper. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tomorrow is the 30th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, the day that British troops opened fire on a Catholic civil rights march in Derry, Northern Ireland, killing 13 people and wounding 14. My guests, journalists Peter Pringle and Philip Jacobson, were part of a team of reporters from the Sunday Times of London, which investigated what happened. They've returned to Derry several times over the years. Their recent book about Bloody Sunday, called Those Are Real Bullets, will be published in paperback in March. You were both sent by the Sunday Times of London to Derry to investigate what happened on Bloody Sunday, and I think you were sent virtually like the day after. Yeah?
Yes, that's correct. Peter arrived before me, but the Insight team, as run then by the editor of the paper, Harold Evans, had a brief really to descend on any incident that seemed worth closer investigation.
Peter, describe to us what Derry looked like and what the emotional state of Derry was when you arrived just after Bloody Sunday.
Well, people were in shock. In great shock, wandering around, not knowing even then exactly how many people had been killed and wounded. It took some time to get the precise figures out. It took an even longer time to understand how many people had been arrested. Some 50-odd people were arrested, and they were processed, so many families didn't know where their loved ones were. But the overall feeling was, how could they have possibly done this? How could the army have come in, paratroopers or not? How could they have shot these people, killed these people, many of whom everybody knew were totally innocent, and the others, if they had been involved in rioting, it was to be throwing stones or bricks or chunks of concrete or iron bars. It was not to have a gun or even to throw a nail bomb or a petrol bomb.
Philip, do you feel that the investigation that you did brought you any closer to being able to answer those questions? How did the British Army end up opening fire? And also, how did they choose their targets? Why were the people who were shot? Why those people?
Well, yes, I do. I think in the circumstances, we did a reasonably thorough job. With a great deal of analysis, we were able to demonstrate that four or possibly five paratroopers fired all the killing shots and probably all the shots that wounded people. We were able to narrow that down to a small unit, a subunit of the paratroop regiment that had been particularly involved. And from there, we were able by analysing the type of wound and a great deal of cross-examination of witnesses. We did all our own interviews, again, with people who had given statements so that it was original material. And step by step, I think Peter would agree, we arrived at a conclusion that discipline had broken down on the ground and a number of paratroopers had fired to kill at unarmed people.
And why do you think?
My own theory is that, as I said, discipline broke down on the ground. The men were hyped up, as I'd said previously. This is an elite regiment designed for smash operations, as they used to call it. I think that once the events took control of the situation, a number of these people, their training, their discipline, or possibly a bloodlust occurred, and they opened fire at Widgery, concluded that their conduct in some cases bordered on the reckless. Well, I would say it bordered on the murderous.
What were some of the challenges you found in trying to reconstruct what happened when you got to Derry shortly after Bloody Sunday?
Well, we had tremendous advantage in that the event had been extremely well covered by the media. There were television pictures, there were lots of still pictures, there were radio reports. So we, first of all, started by gathering all those. And then we were helped by the civil rights movement itself, who took statements from as many of the eyewitnesses as they could. And as Phil said, then we re-interviewed those people. We were able to find some of the wounded still in hospital. We were able to go and interview the IRA officers, command, and then we were particularly helped by an extraordinary event, which was that a radio ham, a man who owned a television and radio repair shop, used to spend his Saturday afternoons recording British Army messages, radio messages, on some of his radios that he'd built himself. And it was his hobby. And on this particular day, he recorded an absolute full recording of the time that the paratroopers drove into the city, to the time they started shooting, to the time they ended shooting. The tapes went for something like, in that case, 3 or 4 hours. And we were able to get hold of those tapes, and we transcribed them, and we were able to piece together from those tapes the exact movements of the army at any particular given minute. And of course, when it came down to the precise killing time, which was only about 20 minutes, the shooting time, we were able to pinpoint, from the knowing where the bodies were, as it were, we were able to find out which units came into the area at what particular time.
What was the tone of the voices on those tapes?
It was very British Army, very matter-of-fact, as one would expect, very unruffled, and very chilling to listen to it in retrospect.
Now, I believe that the British government issued a ban against reporting on Bloody Sunday. Can you describe what that ban was?
Well, the immediate aftermath of Bloody Sunday, there was some debate and some disagreement as to whether the appointment of Lord Widgery to head the first tribunal would invoke what the sub judice law in Britain that has been extremely effective over the centuries almost in limiting media freedom. In our own case, our editor Harold Evans decided that it would probably be counterproductive to go ahead and publish on the first Sunday afterwards, A, because we didn't have the bulk of material that we were looking for, and B, because it would almost inevitably draw enormous hostility down on the head of the Sunday Times and make our job more difficult in the field.
So what was the strategy you used?
Well, we simply went ahead, and our instructions from Harold Evans were, when you've got enough, tell me, and we'll publish as soon as Widgery is published. And we published the first Sunday after the Widgery report came out. It was, as Peter said, it was a counter-investigation. And I think, in retrospect, that we undermined Lord Widgery's conclusions very thoroughly.
Compare your conclusions and his.
Well, he concluded that the British Army had been under fire, that the paratroopers had fired only at legitimate targets, that is, people with weapons or bombs, that discipline at all times had remained. He went out of his way to praise the discipline of the parachute regiment, and he went out of his way to impugn the evidence of eyewitnesses, of civilians who'd been on the march. Ours was exactly the reverse. We looked very closely into the conduct of the parachute regiment. We laid great store on eyewitness testimony from people that we believed to be truly impartial and trustworthy. And we arrived at a conclusion which was more or less diametrically different from Lord Widgery's, in that we believed that the first shots had been fired by the paratroopers, that there had been some IRA response, but in general the response was grotesquely out of proportion.
Of all the people who were arrested on Bloody Sunday, were any of them actually brought to trial and convicted?
No. Not a single person, not one.
How many people were arrested?
Approximately 50. The police processed all the charges and put them before the Director of Public Prosecutions for Northern Ireland. It was decided that in none of those cases would the evidence stand up, and all the cases were dropped.
My guests are journalists Peter Pringle and Philip Jacobson, authors of a book about Bloody Sunday called Those Are Real Bullets. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are journalists Peter Pringle and Philip Jacobson. They're authors of the book Those Are Real Bullets, Bloody Sunday, Derry, 1972. Wednesday, tomorrow, is the 30th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, when the British Army shot 27 Catholics during a civil rights march in Derry. Five were shot in the back, 13 died. In April of 1972, just a few months after Bloody Sunday, the British government released a report saying that the soldiers fired in self-defense or in defense of others who were threatened, and that the soldiers only fired at identified targets, at gunmen and at bombers. But in 1974, the government acknowledged that everyone who was killed in Bloody Sunday was actually innocent. And then Tony Blair recently authorized a new investigation. That report hasn't been released yet. What was behind Tony Blair's authorization of a new investigation into Bloody Sunday?
Well, I think what happened was that, don't forget, we were in the middle of the peace process, as it's called. And although this is an unstated thing by the government, by Tony Blair's government, what happened was that they wanted to push that along as far as possible. And an open wound in the peace process was Bloody Sunday. And so in order to get over that, they ordered a new investigation. It was long overdue. Nobody knew where it was going to go. Nobody knew if they could actually get at the truth. Nobody knew how much money was going to be spent. As it turns out, there is a sort of open budget for this. It's already been going on for more than 2 years. They've spent more than £50 million, $75 million, and they're likely to spend double that before they finish for another 2 years.
Now, you're both actually a part of the story now. Why don't you explain how you are kind of unwilling participants in the British government's reinvestigation of Bloody Sunday?
It all began when Peter and myself were notified individually by the inquiry, which is headed by Lord Saville, the High Court judge, that our material, the material we'd gathered during our investigation, our original investigation, and which had been left with the Sunday Times archive, had been handed over en masse to the inquiry, which meant that they had all our raw notes, our the reports, the inquiries, the analysis that we carried out on the ground. And it really developed from there. We were told quite early on that we would be required as witnesses. There was a subtext that we could be subpoenaed if necessary, although so far exchanges have been fairly polite. But just in these last couple of days, Peter and myself have received what amounts to a final instruction from Lord Saville that we will be required to give evidence, and we will be cross-examined is not quite the right word. We'll be examined on the reports, the testimony, the analysis that we did at that time.
Will you go along with that?
Yes, subject to certain conditions. I think Peter would agree that we made our position very clear at the beginning that we would not give names of people that we'd interviewed under guarantees of anonymity unless we were released by those persons concerned.
I'm wondering, since you've done so many interviews of so many different people on each side involved with Bloody Sunday, have you found that in trying to investigate what happened, that what people tell you is sometimes self-serving? That, you know, people will put the spin on their story that makes their side look best, whether they're part of the paramilitary or part of the IRA or a peaceful marcher in the Civil Rights March?
Well, of course, that does happen in situations like this, but we were, Insight was a fairly sophisticated and extremely experienced group of journalists. And in our initial interviews, we took enormous care to cross-check. We had a large chart pinned to the wall of our hotel where we could identify that marcher A was here and saw marcher B at this point, marchers C then joined them. And we were able to construct a skeleton, really, a fairly complete skeleton of who was where at what time. Photographs were extremely helpful to us because people could... It's such a small community that if you showed one photograph to a couple of people in the pub, they'd probably be able to identify 70% of the people there as shown in it. So we did as well as we could at the time. I think the problem is now, going back as we did for our book, we find that memory plays tricks. Some people have changed their statements. Some people have forgotten, genuinely forgotten what happened and have told Saville they can't remember. And some people, it has to be said, can't recall ever having spoken to the Sunday Times Insight team. That's, I think, quite normal. It's something that Saville is having to get to grips with.
What impact has covering Bloody Sunday had on your lives?
Gee. I think for myself, going back was a extraordinary experience, not only just to see, to go over my notebooks again, but to go back and to see those same people 30 years later in not all that much better position than they were before, quite frankly. The British Army is still there. There has been a tremendous, ghastly record of bombings and shootings since that time. The unemployment rate is down, but it's still high, much higher than the rest of the United Kingdom. They don't have much money. They still live in exactly the same houses, which are not well put together. They still have not much prospect of change in their lives. But their spirit, and this is what really stunned me, is indomitable. Under this regime, they have a fortitude which always stunned me. I saw it then in 1972, and it was still there when we went back after all that time.
Philip, what about you? What would you say has been the impact of covering Bloody Sunday on your life?
On my life? I stayed as an Insight reporter for some time after that, and then became a kind of roving foreign correspondent, which involved inevitably covering wars and disasters. As Peter says, the intensity of Bloody Sunday and in Derry, which is a tiny city and the Catholic community was simply a part of that. I don't think I've ever been involved in such a claustrophobic story, where everywhere you turned, you met somebody who had been involved, who had lost a loved one, who had seen something terrible on that day.
I'm wondering if Bloody Sunday affected the way you each see your own government, the British government.
Well, I certainly have no doubt that that Bloody Sunday represents a huge blot on the record of British justice and, by extension, the government of the day. We now know from cabinet papers that have only recently been cleared for publication that Mr. Ted Heath, the Prime Minister, was determined to present the Army's actions in the best possible light, and he made that very clear to Lord Widgery in appointing him. His words were to the effect that we're fighting a propaganda war here as well as a military war, and you should always remember that. Now, that is not the role of a Prime Minister intent on an impartial inquiry. Mr. Blair, by contrast, though he might well regret the time and expense involved in Saville by now, Mr. Blair went into it, I think, in a better spirit, saying, find out what you can, spend what is necessary, take whatever time you require to produce a report and come up with the truth.
Now, do you think that your conclusions are going to lead this new report to a very different final conclusion than the original report?
Well, I sincerely hope so, because immodestly, perhaps, I think that the Sunday Times Insight team, with the material available at that time and in the time limit that we imposed upon ourselves, got it as nearly right as it was possible to do. Saville, obviously, with his huge resources, immense financing and open time limit, has been able to gather a great deal more information, much of it extremely valuable, and a lot of it, I think, very damaging to the Ministry of Defence's case. And if he fails, in my personal view, if he fails to come up with a judgment that flies straight in the face of the Widgery inquiry, the original inquiry, then he certainly, the people of Derry, the Catholic community of Derry, will believe that he has failed them, British justice has failed them again.
Yeah, so what's at stake here?
A belief in British justice by citizens of the United Kingdom, but also, to a degree, the peace process, although I don't think even an adverse verdict, adverse findings from Lord Savile will have any effect on the level of violence. But there is a huge question of confidence here that Catholics have come a very long way from 1972, but if Savile fails to meet their expectations, which are very high, then I feel that the Northern Ireland troubles will be open-ended again.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Peter Pringle and Philip Jacobson are the authors of a recent book about Bloody Sunday called Those Are Real Bullets. It will be published in paperback in March. Tomorrow is the 30th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Gone, the debut novel by Irish writer Martin Roper. This is Fresh Air.
Martin Roper is an Irish writer whose newly published first novel, Gone, was excerpted a couple of months ago in The New Yorker. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says The New Yorker must have been very selective in choosing what parts of this novel to use.
After I finished Martin Roper's new, much ballyhooed debut novel called Gone, I came to the realization that, even as seasoned as I am, I'm still a gal who can be snookered by a smooth opening line or two. Gone makes readers a lot of promises at the beginning, to take us into realms of emotion we've never experienced in quite that way before, to speak startling phrases into our ears. But then, about halfway through the story, things get stale. By the time it ends, Gone is just going through the motions. It left me feeling cheap, used, and wistful for a reason to believe in the novel I once thought it was. The first-person narrator of Gone goes by his first name, Stephen, and he's a young man in Dublin who has contempt for his father, the Catholic Church, and Ireland in general. Sound familiar? That's part of the deceptive initial thrill of Gone. It revisits the blasted terrain of James Joyce land and inventively updates the place. Stephen's beloved younger sister, Ruth, is in a hospice dying of cancer, and in the first few pages of the novel, he's rushing to her bedside to say goodbye. Here's how Stephen begins his story. I put the telephone down and know Ruth is in the last moments of her life. There have been telephone calls before at odd hours, but never at 4 in the morning. I dress quickly and run out onto an empty Tivoli road. It is dark and raining so heavily, I am soaked by the time I get to where the car should be parked. I can't find it on the road. City of stolen cars. God is testing me. That is what Ruth will say, and I try not to get angry, but it is too late. I am shaking with rage. The most compelling feature of Gone, indeed the one that it sustains throughout its entire narrative, is that staccato rhythm of its present tense sentences. Stephen is always biting off words and muttering phrases under his breath. After Ruth dies and Stephen and his father spend money they don't have on her funeral, we understand more about his background. Stephen's mother abandoned the family when he and Ruth were kids. His father is a house painter, and Stephen himself works in a factory spray-painting TV consoles. He's married to a woman named Ursula, who's a couple of rungs above him on the class ladder. She writes freelance pieces for a Dublin newspaper. Together, they're renovating a house in a shabby section of the city, and they're being harassed nightly by a gang of resentful neighborhood kids who spit at them and throw rocks through the windows. The kids' meanness and Stephen's passivity in the face of it hasten the downfall of his and Ursula's already wobbly marriage. Stephen takes flight and moves to New York City. So far, so good. Gone is atmospheric and offers some fresh takes on people and situations. For instance, when a friend confesses her own marital troubles to Stephen, he thinks to himself, "I feel I am getting old, learning to know that sharing such intimacy is not intimacy. It's nothing but a slide into collusion." But literally speaking, Stephen's relocation to New York is a disaster. There, he meets an older woman named Holfi, who reads like an homage to the late Nico from the Velvet Underground. She's a photographer, originally from Iceland. Now she lives in a hip West Village studio, and she awakens him to the delights of avant-garde art and sadomasochistic sex. Good erotica is a challenge to write. It's got to be compelling but teasing, too solemn, and it gives the reader the giggles. Roper's erotic descriptions are way too solemn to be taken seriously. Holfi, for example, is given to making Nietzschean comments about pain being the pathway to purity in sex. After she brazenly engages in a lesbian dalliance before his eyes, Stephen abandons Holfi for a soul-searching journey through the heart of American highway cliches. Then he travels to Wales to confront his long-lost mother about deserting the family. That's when I finally caught on that all the women in this novel fall into that old virgin whore either-or bin. Gone itself breaks up into two very different kinds of novels. The first half is well worth a read. The second is an embarrassing fictional fling I'd just rather forget.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed the new novel Gone by Martin Roper. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, Lieutenant Colonel Martha McSally, the nation's highest-ranking female fighter pilot. Last month, she filed suit against the Defense Department, challenging regulations requiring female military personnel to adopt Islamic dress and adhere to certain Islamic customs when they're traveling off base. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.